Once they get to a certain part of town, following the T-Bone and Raven show becomes a matter of connect the ambulances. Every couple of blocks, there is a cluster of cops and medics, lights sparkling, radios coughing. All they have to do is go from one to the next. At the first one, there is a dead Crip lying on the pavement. A six-foot-wide blood slick runs from his body, diagonally down the street to a storm drain. The ambulance people are standing around, smoking and drinking coffee from go-cups, waiting for the enforcers to get finished measuring and photographing so that they can haul the corpse to the morgue. There are no IV lines set up, no bits of medical trash strewn around the area, no open doc boxes. They didn't even try. They proceed around a couple of corners to the next constellation of flashing lights. Here the ambulance drivers are inflating a cast around the leg of a medicop. "Run over by the motorcycle," Squeaky says, shaking his head with the traditional enforcer's disdain for their pathetic junior relations, the medicops. Finally, he patches the radio feed into the dashboard so they can all hear it. The motorcyclist's trail is now cold, and it sounds like most of the local cops are dealing with aftermath problems. But a citizen has just called in to complain that a man on a motorcycle and several other persons are trashing a field of hops on her block. "Three blocks from here," Squeaky says to the driver. "Hops?" Hero says. "I know the place. Local microbrewery," Squeaky says. "They grow their own hops. Contracted out to some urban gardeners. Chinese peasants who do the grunt work for them." When they arrive, the first authority figures on the scene, it is obvious why Raven decided to let himself get chased into a hop field. It is great cover. The hops are heavy flowering vines that grow on trellises lashed together out of long bamboo poles. The trellises are 8 feet high. You can't see a thing. They all get out of the car. "T-Bone!" Squeaky hollers. They hear someone yelling in English from the middle of the field.
"Over here!"
But he isn't responding to Squeaky. They walk into the hop field, carefully. There is an enveloping smell, a resiny odor not unlike marijuana, the sharp smell that comes off an expensive beer. Squeaky motions for Hero to stay behind him. In other circumstances, Hero would do so. He is half Japanese, and under certain circumstances, totally respectful of authority. This is not one of those circumstances. If Raven comes anywhere near Hero, Hero is going to be talking to him with his katana. And if it comes to that, Hero doesn't want Squeaky anywhere near him because he could lose a limb on the backswing.
"Yo, T-Bone!" Squeaky yells. "It's the enforcers and we're pissed! Get the fuck out of there, man! Let's go home!"
T-Bone, or Hero assumes it is T-Bone, responds only by firing a short burst from a machine pistol. The muzzle flash lights up the hop vines like a strobe light. Hero aims one shoulder at the ground, buries himself in soft earth and foliage for a few seconds.
"Fuck!"
T-Bone says. It's a disappointed fuck, but a fuck with a heavy undertone of overwhelming frustration and not a little fear. Hero gets up into a conservative squat, looks around. Squeaky and the other enforcer are nowhere to be seen. Hero forces his way through one of the trellises and into a row that is closer to the action. The other enforcer, the driver, is in the same row, about 10 meters away, his back turned to Hero. He glances over his shoulder in Hero's direction, then looks in the other direction and sees someone else. Hero can't quite see who, because the enforcer is in the way. "What the fuck?" the enforcer says. Then he jumps a little, as though startled, and something happens to the back of his jacket.
"Who is it?" Hero says.
The enforcer doesn't say anything. He is trying to turn back around, but something prevents it. Something is shaking the vines around him. The enforcer shudders, careens sideways from foot to foot.
"Gotta get loose!"
he says, speaking loudly to no one in particular. He breaks into a trot, running away from Hero. The other person who was in the row is gone now. The enforcer is running in a strange, stiff, upright gait with his arms down to his sides. His bright green windbreaker isn't hanging correctly. Hero runs after him. The enforcer is trotting toward the end of the row, where the lights of the street are visible. The enforcer exits the field a couple of seconds ahead of him, and when Hero gets to the curb, is in the middle of the road, illuminated mostly by flashing blue light from a giant overhead video screen. He is turning around and around with strange little stomping footsteps, not keeping his balance very well. He is saying, in a low, calm voice that gurgles, as though he badly needs to clear his throat. As the enforcer revolves, Hero perceives that he has been impaled on an 8-foot-long bamboo spear. Half sticks out the front, half out the back. The back half is dark with blood and black fecal clumps. The front half is greenish-yellow and clean. The enforcer can only see the front half, and his hands are playing up and down it, trying to verify what his eyes are seeing. Then the back half whacks into a parked car, spraying a narrow fan of head cheese across the waxed and polished trunk lid. The car's alarm goes off. The enforcer hears the sound and turns around to see what it is. When Hero last sees him, he is running down the center of the pulsating neon street toward the center of Chinatown, wailing a terrible random song that clashes with the bleating of the car alarm. Hero feels even at this moment that something has been torn open in the world and that he is dangling above the gap, staring into a place where he does not want to be, lost in the biomass. Hero draws his katana.
Squeaky! Hero hollers. He's throwing spears! He's pretty good at it! Your driver is hit!
Got it! Squeaky hollers.
Hero goes back into the closest row. He hears a sound off to the right and uses the katana to cut his way through into that row. This is not a nice place to be at the moment, but it is safer than standing in the street under the plutonic light of the video screen. Down the row is a man. Hero recognizes him by the strange shape of his head, which just gets wider until it reaches his shoulders. He is holding a freshly cut bamboo pole in one hand, torn from the trellis. Raven strokes one end of it with his other hand, and a chunk falls off. Something flickers in that hand, the blade of a knife, apparently. He has just cut off the end of the pole at an acute angle to make it into a spear. He throws it fluidly. The motion is calm and beautiful. The spear disappears because it is coming straight at Hero. Hero does not have time to adopt the proper stance, but this is fine since he has already adopted it. Whenever he has a katana in his hands, he adopts it automatically. Otherwise, he fears that he may lose his balance and carelessly lop off one of his extremities. Feet parallel and pointed straight ahead, right foot in front of the left foot, katana held down at groin level like an extension of the phallus. Hero raises the tip and slaps at the spear with the side of the blade, diverting it just enough. It goes into a slow sideways spin, the point missing Hero just barely and entangling itself in a vine on Hero's right. The butt end swings around and gets hung up on the left, tearing out a number of vines as it comes to a stop. It is heavy and traveling very fast. Raven is gone. Mental note. Whether or not Raven intended to take on a bunch of Crips and Enforcers single-handedly tonight, he didn't even bother to pack a gun. Another burst of gunfire sounds from several rows over. Hero has been standing here for rather a long time, thinking about what just happened. He cuts through the next row of vines and heads in the direction of the muzzle flash, running his mouth.
Don't shoot this way, T-Bone! I'm on your side, man!
Motherfucker threw a stick into my chest, man!
T-Bone complains. When you're wearing armor, getting hit by a spear just isn't such a big deal anymore.
Maybe you should just forget it, Hero says.
He is having to cut his way through a lot of rows to reach T-Bone, but as long as T-Bone keeps talking, Hero can find him.
I'm a Crip. We don't forget nothing, T-Bone says. Is that you?
No, Hero says. I'm not there yet.
A very brief burst of gunfire, rapidly cut off. Suddenly, no one is talking. Hero cuts his way into the next row and almost steps on T-Bone's hand, which has been amputated at the wrist. Its finger is still tangled in the trigger guard of a Mac 11. The remainder of T-Bone is two rows away. Hero stops and watches through the vines. Raven is one of the largest men Hero has seen outside of a professional sporting event. T-Bone is backing away from him down the row. Raven, moving with long, confident strides, catches up with T-Bone and swings one hand up into T-Bone's body. Hero doesn't have to see the knife to know it is there. It looks as though T-Bone is going to get out of this with nothing worse than a sewn-on hand and some rehab work, because you can't stab a person to death that way, not if he is wearing armor. T-Bone screams. He is bouncing up and down on Raven's hand. The knife has gone all the way through the bulletproof fabric, and now Raven is trying to gut T-Bone the same way he did Lagos. But his knife, whatever the hell it is, won't cut through the fabric that way. It is sharp enough to penetrate, which should be impossible, but not sharp enough to slash. Raven pulls it out, drops to one knee, and swings his knife hand around in a long ellipse between T-Bone's thighs. Then he jumps over T-Bone's collapsing body and runs. Hero gets the sense that T-Bone is a dead man, so he follows Raven. His intention is not to hunt the man down, but rather to maintain a very clear picture of where he is. He has to cut through a number of rows. He rapidly loses Raven. He considers running as fast as he can in the opposite direction. Then he hears the deep, lung-stretching rumble of a motorcycle engine. Hero runs for the nearest street exit, just hoping to catch a glimpse. He does, though it is a quick one, not a hell of a lot better than the graphic in the cop car. Raven turns to look at Hero just as he is blowing out of there. He's right under a street light, so Hero gets a clear look at his face for the first time. He is Asian. He has a wispy mustache that trails down past his chin. Another Crip comes running out into the street half a second after Hero as Raven is pulling away. He slows for a moment to take stock of the situation, then charges the motorcycle like a linebacker. He is crying out as he does so, a war cry. Squeaky emerges about the same time as the Crip, starts chasing both of them down the street. Raven seems to be unaware of the Crip running behind him, but in hindsight, it seems apparent that he has been watching his approach in the rearview mirror of the motorcycle. As the Crip comes in range, Raven's hand lets go of the throttle for a moment, snaps back as if he is throwing away a piece of litter. His fist strikes the middle of the Crip's face like a frozen ham shot out of a cannon. The Crip's head snaps back. His feet are lifted off the ground. He does most of a backflip and strikes the pavement, hitting first with the nape of his neck, both arms slamming out straight onto the road as he does so. It looks a lot like a controlled fall, though if so, it has to be more reflex than anything. Squeaky decelerates, turns, and kneels down next to the fallen Crip, ignoring Raven. Hero watches the large, radioactive, spear-throwing killer drug lord ride his motorcycle into Chinatown, which is the same as riding into China, as far as chasing him down is concerned. He runs up to the Crip, who is lying crucified in the center of the street. The lower half of the Crip's face is pretty hard to make out. His eyes are half open, and he looks quite relaxed. He speaks quietly. "He's a fucking Indian or something." Interesting idea, but Hero still thinks he's Asian.
"What the fuck did you think you were doing, asshole?" Squeaky says.
He sounds so pissed that Hero steps away from him.
"That fucker ripped us off. The suitcase burned," the Crip mumbles through a mashed jaw. "So why didn't you just write it off? Are you crazy, fucking with Raven like that? He ripped us off. Nobody does that and lives."
"Well, Raven just did," Squeaky says. Finally, he's calming down a little. He rocks back on his heels, looks up at Hero. "T-Bone and your driver are not likely to be alive," Hero says. "This guy better not move. He could have a neck fracture."
"He's lucky I don't fracture his fucking neck," Squeaky says.
The ambulance people get there fast enough to slap an inflatable cervical collar around the Crip's neck before he gets ambitious enough to stand up. They haul him away within a few minutes. Hero goes back into the hops and finds T-Bone. T-Bone is dead. slumped in a kneeling position against a trellis. The stab wound through his bulletproof vest probably would have been fatal, but Raven wasn't satisfied with that. He went down low and slashed up and down the insides of T-Bone's thighs, which are now laid open all the way to the bone. In doing so, he put great lengthwise rents into both of T-Bone's femoral arteries, and his entire blood supply dropped out of him, like slicing the bottom off a styrofoam cup. The enforcers turned the entire block into a mobile cop headquarters, with cars and paddy wagons and satellite links and flatbed trucks. Dudes with white coats are walking up and down through the hop field with Geiger counters. Squeaky is wandering around with his headset, staring into space, carrying on conversations with people who aren't there. A tow truck shows up, towing T-Bone's black BMW behind it.
Yo, Pod!
Hero turns around and looks. It's YT. She's just come out of a Hunan place across the street. She hands Hero a little white box and a pair of chopsticks.
Spicy chicken with black bean sauce, no MSG. You know how to use chopsticks?
Hero shrugs off this insult.
I got a double order, YT continues, because I figure we got some good intel tonight.
Are you aware of what happened here?
No. I mean, some people obviously got hurt.
But you weren't an eyewitness.
No, I couldn't keep up with them.
That's good, Hero says.
What did happen?
Hero just shakes his head. The spicy chicken is glistening darkly under the lights. He has never been less hungry in his life.
If I had known, I wouldn't have gotten you involved. I just thought it was a surveillance job.
What happened?
I don't want to get into it. Look, stay away from Raven, okay?
Sure, she says.
She says it in the chirpy tone of voice that she uses when she's lying and she wants to make sure you know it. Squeaky hauls open the back door of the BMW and looks into the back seat. Hero steps a little closer, gets a nasty whiff of cold smoke. It is the smell of burnt plastic. The aluminum briefcase that Raven earlier gave to T-Bone is sitting in the middle of the seat. It looks like it has been thrown into a fire. It has black smoke stains splaying out around the locks, and its plastic handle is partially melted. The buttery leather that covers the BMW's seats has burn marks on it. No wonder T-Bone was pissed. Squeaky pulls on a pair of latex gloves. He hauls the briefcase out, sets it on the trunk lid, and rips the latches open with a small pry bar. Whatever it is complicated and highly designed. The top half of the case has several rows of the small red-capped tubes that Hero saw at the U store it. There are 5 rows, with maybe 20 tubes in each row. The bottom half of the case appears to be some kind of miniaturized, old-fashioned computer terminal. Most of it is occupied by a keyboard. There is a small liquid crystal display screen that can probably handle about 5 lines of text at a time. There is a pen-like object attached to the case by a cable, maybe 3 feet long, uncoiled. It looks like it might be a light pen or a barcode scanner. Above the keyboard is a lens, set at an angle so that it is aimed at whoever is typing on the keyboard. There are other features whose purpose is not so obvious. A slot, which might be a place to insert a credit or ID card, and a cylindrical socket that is about the size of one of those little tubes. This is Hero's reconstruction of how the thing looked at one time. When Hero sees it, it is melted together, judging from the pattern of smoke marks on the outside of the case, which appear to be jetting outward from the crack between the top and bottom. The source of the flame was inside, not outside. Squeaky reaches down and unsnaps one of the tubes from the bracket, holds it up in front of the bright lights of Chinatown. It had been transparent, but was now smirched by heat and smoke. From a distance, it looks like a simple vial, but stepping up to look at it more closely, Hero can see at least half a dozen tiny individual compartments inside the thing, all connected to each other by capillary tubes. It has a red plastic cap on one end of it. The cap has a black rectangular window, and as Squeaky rotates it, Hero can see the dark red glint of an inactive LED display inside, like looking at the display on a turned-off calculator. Underneath this is a small perforation. It isn't just a simple drilled hole. It is wide at the surface, rapidly narrowing to a nearly invisible pinpoint opening, like the bell of a trumpet. The compartments inside the vial are all partially filled with liquids. Some of them are transparent and some are blackish brown. The brown ones have to be organics of some kind, now reduced by the heat in the chicken soup. The transparent ones could be anything.
"He got out to go into a bar and have a drink," Squeaky mumbles. "What an asshole."
"Who did?"
"T-Bone. See, T-Bone was like the registered owner of this unit, the suitcase. And as soon as he got more than about 10 feet away from it, foosh, it self-destructed."
"Why?"
Squeaky looks at Hero like he's stupid.
"Well, it's not like I work for Central Intelligence or anything. But I would guess that whoever makes this drug, they call it Countdown or Red Cap or Snow Crash, has a real thing about trade secrets. So if the pusher abandons the suitcase or loses it or tries to transfer ownership to someone else, boosh."
"You think the Crips are going to catch up with Raven?"
"Not in Chinatown. Shit," Squeaky says, getting pissed again in retrospect. "I can't believe that guy. I could have killed him."
"Raven?"
"No, that Crip chasing Raven. He's lucky Raven got to him first, not me."
"You were chasing the Crip?"
"Yeah, I was chasing the Crip. What, did you think I was trying to catch Raven?"
"Sort of, yeah. I mean, he's the bad guy, right?"
"Definitely. So I'd be chasing Raven if I was a cop and it was my job to catch bad guys. But I'm an enforcer, and it's my job to enforce order. So I'm doing everything I can, and so is every other enforcer in town, to protect Raven. And if you have any ideas about trying to go and find Raven yourself and get revenge for that colleague of yours that he offed, you can forget it."
"Offed? What colleague?" YT breaks in. She didn't see what happened with Lagos. Hero is mortified by this idea.
"Is that why everyone was telling me not to fuck with Raven? They were afraid I was going to attack him?"
Squeaky eyes the swords.
"You got the means. Why should anyone protect Raven?"
Squeaky smiles as though he has just crossed the border into the realm of kidding around.
"He's a sovereign.
So declare war on him."
"It's not a good idea to declare war on a nuclear power."
"Huh? Christ," Squeaky says, shaking his head. "If I had any idea how little you knew about this shit, I would never let you into my car. I thought you were some kind of a serious CIC wet operations guy. Are you telling me you really didn't know about Raven?"
"Yes, that's what I'm telling you."
"Okay. I'm gonna tell you this so you don't go out and cause any more trouble. Raven's packing a torpedo warhead that he boosted from an old Soviet nuke sub. It was a torpedo that was designed to take out a carrier battle group with one shot. A nuclear torpedo. You know that funny-looking sidecar that Raven has on his Harley? Well, it's a hydrogen bomb, man. Armed and ready. The trigger's hooked up to EEG trodes embedded in his skull. If Raven dies, the bomb goes off. So when Raven comes into town, we do everything in our power to make the man feel welcome."
Hero's just gaping. YT has to step in on his behalf.
"Okay," she says. "Speaking for my partner and myself, we'll stay away from him."
YT reckons she's going to spend all afternoon being a ramp turd.
The surf is always up on the Harbor Freeway, which gets her from downtown into Compton, but the off-ramps into that neighborhood are so rarely used that 3-foot tumbleweeds grow in their potholes. And she's definitely not going to travel into Compton under her own power. She wants to poon something big and fast. She can't use the standard trick of ordering a pizza to her destination and then pooning the delivery boy as he roars past, because none of the pizza chains deliver to this neighborhood. So she'll have to stop at the off-ramp and wait hours and hours for a ride. A ramp turd. She does not want to do this delivery at all, but the franchisee wants her to do it bad. Really bad. The amount of money he has offered her is so high it's stupid. The package must be full of some kind of intense new drug. But that's not as weird as what happens next. She is cruising down the Harbor Freeway, approaching the desired off-ramp, having pooned a southbound semi. A quarter mile from the off-ramp, a bullet-pocked black Oldsmobile cruises past her, right-turn signal flashing. He's going to exit. It's too good to be true. She poons the Oldsmobile. As she cruises down the ramp behind this flatulent sedan, she checks out the driver in his rearview mirror. It is the franchisee himself, the one who is paying her a totally stupid amount of money to do this job. By this point, she's more afraid of him than she is of Compton. He must be a psycho. He must be in love with her. This is all a twisted psycho love plot. But it's a little late now. She stays with him, looking for a way out of this burning and rotting neighborhood. They are approaching a big, nasty-looking mafia roadblock. He guns the gas pedal, headed straight for death. She can see the destination franchise ahead. At the last second, he whips the car around and squeals sideways to a halt. He couldn't have been more helpful. She unpoons as he's giving her this last little kick of energy and sails through the checkpoint at a safe and sane speed. The guards keep their guns pointed at the sky, swivel their heads to look at her butt as she rolls past them. The Compton Nova Sicilia franchise is a grisly scene. It is a jamboree of young mafia. These youths are even duller than the ones from the all-Mormon Deseret Burbclave. The boys are wearing tedious black suits. Their girls are encrusted with pointless femininity. Girls can't even be in the young mafia. They have to be in the girls' auxiliary and serve macaroons on silver plates. Girls is too fine a word for these organisms, too high up the evolutionary scale. They aren't even chicks. She's going way too fast, so she kicks the board around sideways, plants pads, leans into it, skids to a halt, roiling up a wave of dust and grit that dulls the glossy shoes of several young mafia who are milling out front, nibbling dinky Italo treats and playing grown-up. It condenses on the white lace stockings of the young mafia proto-chicks. She falls off the board, appearing to catch her balance at the last moment. She stomps on the edge of the plank with one foot, and it bounces 4 feet into the air, spinning rapidly around its long axis, up into her armpit, where she clamps it tight under one arm. The spokes of the smart wheels all retract, so that the wheels are barely larger than their hubs. She slaps the magnapoon into a handy socket on the bottom of the plank, so that her gear is all in one handy package. YT, she says. Young, fast, and female. Where the fuck's Enzo? The boys decide to get all mature on YT. Males of this age are preoccupied with snapping each other's underwear and drinking until they're in a coma. But around a female, they do the mature thing. It is hilarious. One of them steps forward slightly, interposing himself between YT and the nearest proto-chick.
Welcome to Nova Sicilia, he says. Can I assist you in some way?
YT sighs deeply. She is a fully independent business person, and these people are trying to do a peer thing on her.
Delivery for one Enzo? You know, I can't wait to get out of this neighborhood.
It's a good neighborhood now, the yo ma says.
You should stick around for a few minutes. Maybe you could learn some manners.
You should try surfing the Ventura at rush hour. Maybe you could learn your limitations.
The yo-ma laughs like, okay, if that's how you want it. He gestures toward the door, The man you want to talk to isn't there. Whether he wants to talk to you or not, I'm not sure.
He fucking asked for me, YT says.
He came across the country to be with us, the guy says, and he seems pretty happy with us.
All the other Yomas mumble and nod supportively.
Then why are you standing outside? YT asks, going inside.
Inside the franchise, things are startlingly relaxed. Uncle Enzo is in there, looking just like he does in the pictures, except bigger than YT expected. He is sitting at a desk, playing cards with some other guys in funeral garb. He is smoking a cigar and nursing an espresso. Can't get too much stimulation, apparently. There's a whole Uncle Enzo portable support system in here. A traveling espresso machine has been set up on another desk. A cabinet sits next to it, doors open to reveal a big foil bag of Italian roast water-processed decaf and a box of Havana cigars. There's also a gargoyle in one corner, patched into a bigger-than-normal laptop, mumbling to himself. YT lifts her arm, allows the plank to fall into her hand. She slaps it down on top of an empty desk and approaches Uncle Enzo, unslinging the delivery from her shoulder.
Gino, please,
Uncle Enzo says, nodding at the delivery. Gino steps forward to take it from her.
Need your signature on that, YT says.
For some reason, she does not refer to him as pal or bub. She's momentarily distracted by Gino. Suddenly, Uncle Enzo has come rather close to her, caught her right hand in his left hand. Her courier gloves have an opening on the back of the hand, just big enough for his lips. He plants a kiss on YT's hand. It's warm and wet, not slobbery and gross, not antiseptic and dry either. Interesting. The guy has confidence going for him. Christ, he's slick. Nice lips. Sort of firm, muscular lips, not gelatinous and blubbery like 15-year-old lips can be. Uncle Enzo has a very faint, citrus and aged tobacco smell to him. Fully smelling it would involve standing pretty close to him. He is towering over her, standing at a respectable distance now, glinting at her through crinkly old guy eyes. Seems pretty nice.
I can't tell you how much I've been looking forward to meeting you, YT, he says.
Hi, she says. Her voice sounds chirpier than she likes it to be. So she adds,
what's in that bag that's so fucking valuable anyway?
Absolutely nothing, Uncle Enzo says.
His smile is not exactly smug. More embarrassed, like what an awkward way to meet someone.
It all has to do with imageering, he says, spreading one hand dismissively. There are not many ways for a man like me to meet with a young girl that do not generate incorrect images in the media. It's stupid, but we pay attention to these things.
So, what did you want to meet with me about? Got a delivery for me to make?
All the guys in the room laugh. The sound startles YT a little, reminds her that she is performing in front of a crowd. Her eyes flick away from Uncle Enzo for a moment. Uncle Enzo notices this. His smile gets infinitesimally narrower, and he hesitates for a moment. In that moment, all the other guys in the room stand up and head for the exit.
You may not believe me, he says, but I simply wanted to thank you for delivering that pizza a few weeks ago.
Why shouldn't I believe you? She asks.
She is amazed to hear nice, sweet things coming out of her mouth. So is Uncle Enzo.
I'm sure you, of all people, can come up with a reason.
So, she says, you having a nice day with all the young mafia?
Uncle Enzo gives her a look that says, watch it, child. A second after she gets scared, she starts laughing. Because it's a put-on, he's just giving her a hard time. He smiles, indicating that it's okay for her to laugh. YT can't remember when she's been so involved in a conversation. Why can't all people be like Uncle Enzo?
Let me see, Uncle Enzo says, looking at the ceiling, scanning his memory banks. I know a few things about you.
that you are 15 years old, you live in a burb clave in the valley with your mother?
I know a few things about you, too, Y.T. hazards.
Uncle Enzo laughs.
Not nearly as much as you think, I promise.
Tell me,
what does your mother think of your career?
Nice of him to use the word career.
She's not totally aware of it, or doesn't want to know.
You're probably wrong, Uncle Enzo says.
He says it cheerfully enough, not trying to cut her down or anything.
You might be shocked at how well-informed she is. This is my experience, anyway. What does your mother do for a living?
She works for the feds.
Uncle Enzo finds that richly amusing.
And her daughter is delivering pizzas for Nova Sicilia. What does she do for the feds?
Some kind of thing where she can't really tell me in case I blab it. She has to take a lot of polygraph tests.
Uncle Enzo seems to understand this very well.
Yes, a lot of Fed jobs are that way.
There is an opportune silence.
It kind of freaks me out, YT says.
The fact that she works for the Feds?
The polygraph tests. They put a thing around her arm to measure the blood pressure.
A sphygmomanometer,
Uncle Enzo says crisply.
It leaves a bruise around her arm. For some reason, that kind of bothers me.
It should bother you.
And the house is bugged, so when I'm home, no matter what I'm doing, someone else is probably listening.
Well, I can certainly relate to that,
Uncle Enzo says. They both laugh.
I'm going to ask you a question that I've always wanted to ask a courier, Uncle Enzo says. I always watch you people through the windows of my limousine. In fact, when a courier poons me, I always tell Peter, my driver, not to give them a hard time. My question is, you are covered from head to toe in protective padding, so why don't you wear a helmet?
The suit's got a cervical airbag that blows up when you fall off the board so you can bounce on your head. Besides, helmets feel weird. They say it doesn't affect your hearing, but it does.
You use your hearing quite a bit in your line of work?
Definitely, yeah.
Uncle Enzo is nodding.
That's what I suspected. We felt the same way, the boys in my unit in Vietnam.
I heard you went to Vietnam, but...
She stops, sensing danger.
You thought it was hype. No, I went there. Could have stayed out if I'd wanted, but I volunteered.
You volunteered to go to Vietnam?
Uncle Enzo laughs.
Yes, I did. The only boy in my family to do so.
Why?
I thought it would be safer than Brooklyn.
YT laughs.
A bad joke, he says. I volunteered because my father didn't want me to, and I wanted to piss him off.
Really?
Definitely. I spent years and years finding ways to piss him off. Dated black girls, grew my hair long, smoked marijuana. But the capstone, my ultimate achievement, even better than having my ear pierced, was volunteering for service in Vietnam. But I had to take extreme measures even then.
YT's eyes dart back and forth between Uncle Enzo's creased and leathery earlobes. In the left one, she just barely sees a tiny diamond stud.
What do you mean, extreme measures?
Everyone knew who I was. Word gets around, you know. If I had volunteered for the regular army, I would have ended up stateside filling out forms, maybe even at Fort Hamilton right there in Bensonhurst. To prevent that, I volunteered for special forces, did everything I could to get into a frontline unit.
He laughs.
And it worked. Anyway, I'm rambling like an old man. I was trying to make a point about helmets.
Oh, yeah.
Our job was to go through the jungle making trouble for some slippery gentlemen carrying guns bigger than they were. Stealthy guys. And we depended on our hearing, too, just like you do. And you know what? We never wore helmets.
Same reason?
Exactly. Even though they didn't cover the ears, really, they did something to your sense of hearing. I still think I owe my life to going bareheaded.
That's really cool. That's really interesting.
You'd think they would have solved the problem by now.
Yeah, Whitey volunteers. Some things never change, I guess.
Uncle Enzo throws back his head and belly laughs. Usually YT finds this kind of thing pretty annoying, but Uncle Enzo just seems like he's having a good time, not putting her down. YT wants to ask him how he went from the ultimate rebellion to running the family beeswax. She doesn't. But Uncle Enzo senses that it is the next natural subject of the conversation.
Sometimes I wonder who'll come after me, he says. Oh, we have plenty of excellent people in the next generation. But after that, well, I don't know. I guess all old people feel like the world is coming to an end.
You got millions of those young mafia types, YT says.
All destined to wear blazers and shuffle papers in suburbia. You don't respect those people very much, YT, because you're young and arrogant. But I don't respect them much either, because I'm old and wise.
This is a fairly shocking thing for Uncle Enzo to be saying, but YT doesn't feel shocked. It just seems like a reasonable statement coming from her reasonable pal, Uncle Enzo.
None of them would ever volunteer to go get his leg shot off in the jungle, just to piss off his old man. They lack a certain fiber. They are lifeless and beaten down.
That's sad, YT says.
It feels better to say this than to trash them, which was her first inclination.
Well, says Uncle Enzo,
it is the well that begins the end of a conversation.
I was going to send you some roses, but you wouldn't really be interested in that, would you?
Oh, I wouldn't mind, she says,
sounding pathetically weak to herself.
Here's something better, since we are comrades in arms, he says.
He loosens his tie and collar, reaches down into his shirt, pulls out an amazingly cheap steel chain with a couple of stamped silver tags dangling from it.
These are my old dog tags, he says. Been carrying them around for years, just for the hell of it. I would be amused if you would wear them.
Trying to keep her knees steady, she puts the dog tags on. They dangle down onto her coverall.
Better put them inside, Uncle Enzo says.
She drops them down into the secret place between her breasts. They are still warm from Uncle Enzo.
Thanks.
It's just for fun, he says. But if you ever get into trouble, and you show those dog tags to whoever it is that's given you a bad time, then things will probably change very quickly.
Thanks, Uncle Enzo.
Take care of yourself.